This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
And that's what's happening. China is flooding the world with cheap batteries. Those batteries are getting deployed at utility scale all over the world, which is enabling all the countries that deploy them to incorporate more wind and solar onto their system. And so the whole global system is migrating toward this electrotech based around wind and solar and batteries primarily.
Oil is not the stated justification for the recent U.S.-Israel joint attack on Iran. The ensuing war is, however, expected to cause major disruptions to the global oil and gas supply. Which brings us to our topic this week on Sea Change Radio, energy transitions. Today we're talking about pivots undertaken by some of the world's largest economies. We're joined by Chris Nelder, an energy expert and the host of the Energy Transition Show podcast. We discuss the problems facing Japan and its growing energy needs 15 years after the Fukushima nuclear disaster. Examine China's impressive moves away from fossil fuel dependency, and talk about Germany's nimble reinvention of its energy grid after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Chris Nelder. He's the host and producer of the Energy Transition Show podcast. Chris, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Good to be back.
I wanted to do a bit of a geopolitical overview. You've been doing some excellent work at the Energy Transition Show, and I wanted to drill down into the Asian countries that you have focused on recently. Why don't we first start with this piece that you did entitled Japan, Petrostate or Electrostate. It was an interview with Nobuo Tanaka, who's the former executive director of the International Energy Agency, the IEA. It was very interesting. Why don't you explain what you meant by petrostate or electrostate for our listeners?
You know, the basic idea is there are some countries that are still staying on that sort of 20th century pathway of fossil fuels with a largely petroleum-driven economy. So that's your petrostates. And then there are countries that are moving toward electrification and providing that electricity with renewables, clean electricity. And so that's the electrostate strategy. And so it's been an interesting way to think about the world. A couple of salient countries you could think about is obviously the Middle Eastern countries have very much been petrostates, but so is the United States, and especially under Trump's presidency, where he's trying to do everything he can to stop the energy transition and drag the U.S. back into a fossil-fueled economy. And in fact, we just did a whole nother episode about that, about the many, many, many ways that he has been attacking the energy transition.
Yes, I saw that and I was tempted to talk to you about that, but I think it's just too depressing, to be honest. So I wanted to focus on something that doesn't hit our autonomic nervous system so devastatingly.
Well, I mean, it's just the reality that we're in, right? So he's doing everything he can to stop wind farms, to stop solar farms, to, just recently repealed the endangerment finding within the EPA, which is sort of the basis for U.S. climate policy, and a lot of other things, including, seizing Venezuela's oil, trying to create a new way for the U.S. oil majors to get involved there again, and many, many other ways that the U.S. is really clinging to that petrostate strategy under Trump. Whereas China, which for many, many years has been the largest emitter, the largest coal user, is now the world leader without a doubt by orders of magnitude in terms of its ability to create solar and wind gear and to deploy it domestically. So they are by far the world leader in terms of clean energy production. And they're also now finally starting to, that new renewable capacity is now finally starting to push coal off their grid. Very slowly, but it is. And at the same time, China is also pursuing these electric technologies, right? So they're deploying electric vehicles. They've now become the largest electric vehicle car market in the world. They are now the largest producer of electric vehicles on a country basis. exporting them to much of the rest of the world. And then there's all the other kinds of electric technology, heat pumps and, you know, various kinds of grid tech and so on that they're also deploying. And so China has been rapidly migrating on Tanaka-san's chart from being a petrostate in many ways to electrostate, whereas the U.S. is migrating the other way. You know, we had been a leader in renewable technologies and in energy transition technologies sort of writ large, and we're now moving back toward the fossil fuel strategy, and with an emphasis on oil and gas. So that's a way to think about the petrostate, electrostate framing. Obviously, every country in the world has its own unique set of challenges and opportunities within that framing, which is why I've been traveling around the world for the past several years as much as possible to interview people and interview and explore and research the state of different countries and different regions with respect to their own opportunities to explore renewable energy and to adopt electrotech, and specifically which countries are really rapidly abandoning the fossil fuel strategy or about to and leap into the electrotech future. So this is broadly characteristic of Asia. But, you know, I was just in South Africa for 6 weeks last year, working on a mini-series based on the interviews I conducted there. And it's amazing to see how the poster child of coal dependency, really, in the world, South Africa, is now this year preparing to adopt its first wholesale electricity market, which the whole electric system for decades has been run by the state-owned company, Eskom, and totally dependent on coal. And now they're creating a new wholesale market, which will allow opportunities for wind and solar developers and lots of other developers to come in and become a competitive market in electricity, which ultimately will result in them adopting a lot more renewables and pushing coal off their grid. So very exciting story there in South Africa. But, you know, every country has its own particular set of challenges and opportunities.
I'm going back to Japan for the first time in, I don't know, it's been almost 20 years. I lived there for quite some time in the 90s, but I'm interested in your perspective on the evolution of the Japanese grid. And now that we're looking at about 15 years of the anniversary of the Fukushima disaster, how that affected their energy transition.
It's my perception at this point, based on the knowledge that I have and the interviews that I've done, that Japan has largely lost 15 years. It's been more than a lost decade of opportunity to make some progress on the energy transition. And the main reason for that is that, you know, after shutting down most of their nuclear fleet and after the Fukushima disaster, they've really been on the horns of this dilemma where they want to restart the fleet because it is very large. It was providing most of their electricity. It is clean. And it's really the technology that made sense for them because of their limited land available. And, you know, the fact that a lot of Japan is quite mountainous. And so, you know, the kind of renewable technologies that work in other parts of the world, wind and solar, have, you know, more limited opportunity in Japan. And even geothermal is challenged in Japan because in places where geothermal vents rise close to the surface, Japan famously has this whole onsen culture of, you know, hot springs, and they are reluctant to have geothermal technologies deployed there because they're afraid that it would steal the heat that they use for their hot springs. And so renewables have been harder for Japan to deploy. They have deployed a significant amount of them in some parts of the country. As I traveled across the country on the bullet train, I noticed there were some sections of the country that I passed through that had quite a lot of solar, but it's not widespread. And when you have a place like Tokyo with whatever it is, 38 million people in one packed into one place, there's only so much rooftop space you have available there. And it's nowhere near what you would need to be, you know, provide a significant amount of power with solar. So Japan has been stuck, sort of unable to move forward with renewables because it wants to resurrect its nuclear fleet, unable to resurrect the nuclear fleet because of mainly public opposition. The public really lost trust and faith in TEPCO, the electric utility that owns the fleet. And so they've just been sort of stuck in neutral for 15 years or so. And It's really been a challenge for them to figure out how to move forward. They just recently restarted the first reactor that had been shut down for most of that time, the past 15 years, and you know, they had some technical problems and had to shut it down right away. And it looks like they're kind of working through a process here to really get that back into full operational condition. But it's been difficult for them. And as far as the opportunity to explore renewables goes, I don't think they've probably really explored it as much as they could have because of that dilemma.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to Chris Nelder from the Energy Transition Show podcast. If you had looked 30, 35 years ago at the countries that were best poised for becoming electro states in 2026, I think Japan would be at the top of that list. They had really embraced the idea of mass transit. They were one of the first countries to really put an extensive train system nationally and culturally. Mass transit has been embraced, very much unlike we have here in the U.S. They were very early adopters of recycling, and they're just conscious of sustainability precepts in many ways. And yet, as you mentioned, they really have been stuck in neutral since Fukushima. Moving forward, what are their best routes and avenues to become an electro state and not a petro state, Chris?
Well, you know, it remains to be seen. I mean, I think most of the senior leadership in Japan, the political leadership, and really the leadership within the energy industry broadly, is still very committed to reviving its nuclear fleet. I think one of the remarkable aspects of how Japan dealt with the closure of most of its nuclear fleet very suddenly after Fukushima, they did two things. They really actively and aggressively deployed energy efficiency technologies and rapidly gained efficiencies in a number of different sectors, just all sorts of appliances. But they also really went through a lot of hardship. You know, a lot of people just simply went without electricity when it had been, you know, readily available before the disaster. And so there was a real national effort to deal with the situation through austerity of electricity and through electrification with very, very high efficiency appliances. And now the choices before them really are to stick with that nuclear strategy, which again, I think most of the political leadership and energy industry leadership is still depending and counting on. And again, this is a very, very large investment. There's a big capital investment sitting there that they are loath to abandon. However, should they start seeing their way clear to start exploring really what the renewable potential is, and again, I still have yet to see any really good analyses of what the potential is for Japan or for these different renewable technologies. And I'm actually actively still talking with people and researching that and trying to get my head around what really is the opportunity for them. But it seems like the things that they still really could explore is regular solar, ground-mounted or roof-mounted. There's still plenty of opportunity to do more of that. But also floating offshore is something that they're starting to explore. And then as far as wind goes, it's pretty much going to be a floating offshore turbine strategy for them because the continental shelf drops away very quickly once you get offshore Japan. And so the strategy that's worked well in, say, Northern Europe, where you can have wind turbines on a fixed bottom, in other words, standing on the ocean floor in a tower, that's not going to work. They're going to have to use floating turbines, which is semi-submersible technology that is well known and developed by the oil and gas industry, and it's starting to be explored in different parts of the world. It's expensive. It's still very much at an early stage of technological development, I would say, for wind turbines anyway. Certainly not for oil and gas platforms. Those have been operating in deep water for many, many years. So that might be a way that they can go. And I do think that they could probably do a lot more with geothermal without disrupting the onsen sector. But that's going to also be quite politically fraught for them.
If you were a Japanese policymaker, what kind of lessons could you learn from what Korea has been doing over the last 15 years or so?
Tanaka-san really felt like there's an opportunity here for sort of an ASEAN collective strategy. You know, the different Asian countries could get together and work cooperatively toward more of a electrotech strategy, even as Japan tries to sort of straddle the fence and still remain close to the United States in terms of energy trade, because Japan still imports a lot of LNG. You know, a big part of their way that they adapted to the loss of their nuclear fleet was to radically increase the amount of LNG they're importing. And so they are now very dependent on gas, and all of that gas is imported. They don't have any gas resources domestically.
And just to add to that, Tanaka-san mentioned in that interview how one of the problems with gas and long-term planning is you can't really have reserves of gas. It doesn't store.
It is a lot harder to store gas because it has to be under pressure and it wants to leak. So those who remember the Aliso Canyon field, gas field in Southern California leaking a couple years ago will remember this. Gas can be stored. Usually it's being stored in a depleted gas field. Oddly enough, you know, because that was where the gas came from and it was able to stay there. And so in some cases where you've got the need for gas storage, what they're doing now is taking imported gas and then stuffing it back into the underground reservoir where their original gas came from that they've already now burned. But yeah, it is much harder to store gas. It does require more of a continuous, ongoing, supply chain. So Japan is still very dependent on that gas, and as a result, it wants to remain close to the U.S. because a lot of the gas that it imports comes from the U.S., whereas it also is in Asia. It's part of Asia. And the Asian strategy writ large is to move to electrotech. That's what China's doing. That's what, you know, many of the other Asian countries are starting to do. It was believed for many, many years that the whole world would follow the same path that the developed world, the rich world countries followed in exploiting fossil fuels first and then migrating over to renewables and electrotech. That is clearly not what's happening. What's happening instead is this electrotech has now become so cheap and so available and so superior, really, in every way to technologies that burned fossil fuels, that many Asian countries are now leapfrogging to electrotech, and they're abandoning fossil fuels much, much earlier than anyone expected. And so there's an opportunity there for Japan and Korea and China and other Asian countries to work together on the electrotech side of things, even while Japan tries to, again, straddle the fence and stay on good terms with the U.S., from which it imports so much of its natural gas.
And we haven't really touched upon India. Is there any insight there in the world's most populous country? And how are they coming along in their energy transitions?
I mean, India is really a great case in point. There was a recent report done by Kingsmill Bond and his colleagues at Ember, which I highly recommend that people check out, where they're showing that at a similar state of economic development to China, India is adopting renewables much earlier than China did. And so if you kind of adjust for GDP per capita or whatever your baseline is and plot the two next to each other, it becomes very obvious that India is adopting renewables and moving into this electrotech future much more quickly even than China did. And China, again, is by far the world leader in all of that stuff. So it's very clear that India is rapidly adopting solar. it's rapidly adopting wind, it's rapidly adopting batteries and EVs, and to the extent that the global fossil fuel industry was counting on India as being this massive, you know, future market that they could sell to, that market is evaporating. They're just not going to be there to consume fossil fuels in the future the way that everybody in the fossil fuel industry, I think, expected they would.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Chris Nelder from the Energy Transition Show podcast. Circling back to the Japanese conundrum and their difficulties in transitioning from their nuclear fleet, could you maybe draw some parallels for our listeners with Germany? Maybe you can give us an update on Germany, and what does that tell us about the future of nuclear energy?
At the sort of high-level narrative level that you're speaking about it right now, it does seem like they're parallel. In my mind, they're really not, because, I mean, look, a lot of people incorrectly believed that Germany started to abandon its nuclear fleet because of Fukushima. That is incorrect. A lot of people have repeated that over and over again. You could get on CNBC or any financial press or any single part of the last 15 years and you would hear that story. It's wrong. Germany's resistance to nuclear technology really began in the 1960s. And it was because their, you know, industrial leadership was causing or forcing these nuclear plants to be built out in rural areas where farmers lived, and the farmers didn't want them there. And so there was a popular backlash against the German government forcing these nuclear plants to be located where the people who lived there did not want them. And that was the original, that was the origin of the Energiewende, the energy transition in German. The German attitude toward nuclear power went through a whole series of waves, really, I guess I would say, since the 1960s. There were times when there was a lot of resistance to it, and then there was, you know, a more favorable attitude toward it, and they proceeded with building some reactors, then they started to shut them down, and then they lit them back up again, and you know, there was a back and forth. It wasn't one clear direction, and there were a lot of reasons for that. There was popular reasons, there were economic reasons, there was political reasons. It's a very complex story, and it's in no way equivalent to the Japanese story in my mind. It's just a totally different context. But Germany did decide that they're going to leave nuclear as an energy generation technology. They decided that many years ago, and they made a plan. And again, there were some fits and starts, but basically they proceeded with it and executed that plan, and they shut down their last reactor a couple years ago. And all of the catastrophizing that was done about that, a lot of people who favored the nuclear industry or favored nuclear technology, who thought that that would cause a massive spike in Germany's emissions or a massive spike in their grid costs or what have you because they were moving to renewables instead, most of those horrible things that they said would happen did not happen. And although Germany did rebound to gas in a significant way, it wasn't entirely, and they are now very impressively incorporating renewables into their grid power mix, although they still use a lot of gas. But they also, because of Putin's invasion of Ukraine, they did manage to eliminate Russian gas from their grid power supply in a very short period of time. I think it was less than 2 years. And that was a remarkable transformation for them. They found alternate suppliers, largely the U.S., to bring in gas from. But that meant that they had to construct LNG import facilities, whereas they had been getting their gas from Russia via pipeline, right? And so it's a totally different industry that they had to stand up, really, in a lot of ways. And they have increasingly been deploying more renewables, and they've managed to get by without nuclear, without radically increasing their emissions. stations. They're also phasing out, you know, their coal plants. That's another long-term plan that has been in place, and they're slowly executing on it, just sort of one plant at a time.
And that was kind of one of the parallels that I remember reading about 15 years ago in both Japan and Germany, experts saying, well, if you don't have nuclear, you're going to have coal. But we've seen that that's not necessarily the case.
No, definitely not. I mean, look, the nuke nuts have said all kinds of crazy stuff and created all sorts of horror stories about what was going to happen and projected all these wild scenarios, and it just none of it came true. It was just I don't know why people believe in nuclear the way that they do. It doesn't make any sense to me. It's obvious to me that the world does not need nuclear power. Wind and solar are by far the cheapest way to put up a new kilowatt of generation capacity now, basically all over the world, and without any of the risk that nuclear entails, without the big long timelines and the massive capital expenditures. When you incorporate more wind and solar onto your grid, it actually becomes more predictable, not less. And one of the biggest risks to a large grid is when a large nuclear plant has to suddenly shut down because of, you know, some safety issue. That's a real problem for a grid operator to manage when you suddenly have gigawatts of power just kind of disappear unexpectedly. Whereas that just doesn't really happen with wind and solar. We know when the sun comes up and when it goes down. Our ability to forecast weather is really quite good. Grid operators have excellent visibility over when they're going to have wind and solar on their grid and when they're not, and they're able to plan around that. You know, it's really just kind of a simple engineering problem ultimately, and the more storage you get on your system, the more you can accommodate the variability. I refuse to use the word intermittent or intermittency for wind and solar. And that's what's happening. China is flooding the world with cheap batteries. Those batteries are getting deployed at utility scale all over the world, which is enabling all the countries that deploy them to incorporate more wind and solar onto their system. And so the whole global system is migrating toward this electrotech based around wind and solar and batteries primarily. And we just don't, you know, nuclear power is going to get phased out along with the rest of fossil fuels if you let the market decide. Now, obviously, in the United States and a few other places, they are not letting the market decide. They are exercising the heavy hand of federal government to force the energy system to go back in the direction of nuclear and fossil fuels. So they are clearly not fans of the free market. They are clearly fans of big state control, which, of course, is the opposite of what they've claimed for decades. And so it's a very strange situation that we're in right now.
Always appreciate your insights. Chris Nelder is the host of the Energy Transition Show podcast. Chris, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You bet. Thanks, Alex. Sway the future to the past and find what will
endure. You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by James Brown, George Harrison, and Tower of Power. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.